has expertise in classical Sanskrit poetry, in Indian philosophy, Puranic literature, manuscript studies, so many fields. And so we're very honoured to have him with us today. And he's going to speak to us in these sessions on the conceptions of liberation in classical Indian philosophy, with particular focus on the Nyayamanjari. So that's what I have to say by way of introduction. And so I shall hand it over to you.
Thank you very much, Gavin. Thank you for the invitation. Thanks to OCHS and you in particular, and also other people who helped everything to somehow work, since I'm sorry I was a very complicated case, evidently. But it's wonderful to be here. And I'm not going to speak to you, or maybe I will try to speak to you, but I don't. This is not going to be in the nature of a lecture, I fear, mainly because I haven't been able to do enough work, really. This is a topic I'm trying to study a little bit myself, but I find it a very huge topic, this question of the nature of liberation. After all, everybody says liberation. This is the ultimate aim or something like this in classical Indian thought. Almost everybody seems to hold this view. But what is this liberation? On this, there are many different views indeed. And it seems to be a subject which has not been studied that much, as far as I can tell, at least not in a really comprehensive way. Though some contributions have recently been made. For instance, a very nice book has just come out. I haven't actually seen the physical book yet. Have you seen that yet? Mm-hmm. Now, somehow a copy hasn't reached me yet. But I've seen earlier drafts. A very nice book studying edition and translation and study of Paramoksha Nirasa Karika of the Shaiva Siddhanta author Satya Jyotis and his commentator Ramakanta. Now, that work, 20 views, I believe it is, on liberation are discussed, 20 other views of others are discussed by this Siddhantika and refuted. But this 20, again, it's not all the views that there are, of course. So it's an absolutely vast topic. And to study it historically also with a real eye to what is going on as time goes by, how these views develop and interact with each other, I think it's just, mind-blowingly big, if you like. So what we are going to do is take a very small part indeed of this topic. I'm using as my entry point this work by Jayanta Bhatta, the Nyayamanjari, which gives us a very attractive snapshot of Jayanta's time. Now, Jayanta is, as many of you probably know, he's an important writer. He's a rather great writer, I think, of the 9th century. People have their own lists, I suppose, of their top philosophers and their top thinkers in India. I'm not sure how many people would put Jayanta on their top 5 list of philosophers. I'm not sure also that he would be on my top 5, but maybe somewhere in the top 10 at least. I find him a very impressive thinker indeed, very clear. Some people sometimes take pot shots at him as being not very original, but I think there is some degree of originality, and this is another thing which is always very hard to determine, because we often do not know enough about the literature that existed pre-Jayanta. But I find him a very clear thinker. I find him particularly admirable as a thinker for his the clarity with which, and the fairness overall, at least, with which he presents the Purva Pakshas. So, Indian philosophers do not always present their opponents absolutely fairly. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's very difficult for academics to do, too, as you notice. But I think Jayanta does much better at it than most people do, at least. For instance, when he presents the Buddhists' positions, the Buddhists are for him one of the most important opponents. He shows really deep knowledge, I think, and understanding of the Buddhist position, and even sympathy with it. That is, he writes the Purva Pakshas as you should, such that when you read them, you feel, yes, this really is starting to sound very, very convincing. And then, of course, all of this is a setup to refute it all the more decisively later. But anyway, I think he shows very deep understanding, the ability to understand other people's thoughts, which is, again, not always... it's a very difficult thing. It's something that people are not always so successful at. So he's a distinguished author for me, at least, in this regard. And he's also a rather elegant writer, I think, although... I'm not sure that what we're going to read there is any very great literary merit. Nonetheless, I think he has skill also as a poet. This is displayed, of course, most perhaps in his play. We have one play by him, the Agamardambara, the subject of a DPhil thesis here in Oxford some time ago. Out of that DPhil thesis, the translation grew that has been published in the Clay Sanskrit Library, a quite attractive translation. That play, I think, is very attractive indeed. It's rather beautiful. I even think it's more beautiful than Chapa realized when writing the dissertation. He's later, when I read the play again, it seemed to me also that he's doing some very subtle things, not all of which we yet grasp, perhaps, when we were reading it with Chapa that time round. So I find him very admirable indeed. And in the Nyaya Manjari, if you read the opening section, the opening verses, I think are also very elegant. They reveal, incidentally, something of his literary preferences, because the opening verse of the Nyaya Manjari is clearly calked upon the opening verse of the Kadambari of Bana. It's very clear that Bana was one of Jayanta's great heroes. Bana is the great mainly prose poetry, of the beginning of the 7th century. Very great Sanskrit writer indeed. Jayanta must have loved him. I think you see this at various places in the Nyaya Manjari. We can also guess it perhaps from the fact that Jayanta's son, Abhinanda, wrote a Kadambari Katasara, which is itself a very elegant composition, by the way. Rather simple, perhaps, being composed mainly in Anushtup, but very elegant. Sorry for that long digression about his style. Well, maybe we might see some touches of elegance here, though for the most part this is going to be rather functional writing. So, in the Nyaya Manjari, what is this work, the Nyaya Manjari? This is his major work of the works that survived to us. This is the one which clearly we can label a magnum opus. It's quite huge. It's almost an encyclopedia of Indian philosophy of his time. It really covers very important subjects in great detail, and minor subjects usually in not so much detail. It is a sort of a commentary on the Nyaya Sutras, if you like, but not really, because the topics are basically rearranged. He says himself at the beginning in a famous passage that he is just presenting the essence of the teachings of Gautama with no additions of his own. He does not claim originality. What is it again? Nyayaushadivanebhyoyam ahrittaha paramorasaha. This is the supreme essence which I've extracted from whole forests of medicinal herbs of Nyaya. Idam anvikshiki kshirat navanitam ivodratam. This is, as it were, the fresh butter that I've churned out of the milk of philosophy. And then indeed he says that he's not adding you. But how could somebody like me think up some new stuff, some new content? Those are verses which are rather elegantly written, don't you think? That's from the opening section of the Nyaya Manjari. So this is sort of, it's meant to be a presentation of the, or he claims that it's a presentation of the essence of the Nyaya, the old Nyaya teachings. But of course his real goal in the text is to probably refute the Buddhists above all. This is what most of the energy seems to be going into when you look at it. One interesting question which I'd just like to raise very briefly before we start reading a little bit of the text. Is Jayanta really a Nayayika? Well, I think obviously he is. But I just want to say that these labels such as Nayayika, etc., are can be misleading if we just say, okay, we're putting Jayanta into a box, we're labeling him as, he's a Nayayika. Okay, now I know how Jayanta thinks. This is not the case, because Jayanta is, well, it's not the case even for many other figures in Indian thought too, but I think Jayanta especially is such a clever person and such a deep person, I feel. I mean, you really feel that he's, if you like, a modern person, but this is a prejudiced use that we have of the word modern, because people tend to think that only modern people are complex. Actually, people are complex at all times. Anyway, I think he's a very complex person indeed. I don't want to try to psychoanalyze him. But at least if we simply label him a Nayayika, I think this is undercutting his scholarship and what he is. For one thing, of course, he became famous apparently in his own time, early as a grammarian. And the third major strand to lift out there is that he's also a mimamsaka. I think this is clear if you read the Agamadambra. Again, without wishing or claiming to be able to psychoanalyze Jayanta or really understand him very deeply, still it seems clear if you read the Agamadambra that the central figure, this chap, the young chap full of energy, Sankarsana, that he is basically some kind of an alter ego on some level of Jayanta, that Jayanta seems to identify himself to some sort of the Mimamsaka, and the whole thing then ends in the alliance between the Mimamsaka and the Nayayika, and we can say that this is, to some respect, this must represent some of what Jayanta is himself, if you like. I think he has great sympathy, and of course very deep knowledge of Mimamsa. It's terribly impressive in this regard, the Nyayamandiri on the Mimamsa side. He's a Mimamsaka, maybe first of all, but he is turning to Nyaya as he sees that Nyaya, according to him, has the more powerful tools with which to defeat the Buddhists. I think this is really the essence of why he put his major effort into the Nyayamandiri instead of into writing a commentary on the Shlokavartika or something like that. He thinks that the Nayaka's arguments in this regard are really stronger, more effective. So he's a grammarian, he's a Nayaka and a Mimamsaka. In other words, he is Padavakya Pramana Gyaha. This is the old term for a scholar, quite an old term, at least pre-Jayanta, I think. I think there are pre-Jayanta attestations of this term. A real scholar is somebody who knows these three shastras, the shastra of words, in other words, grammar, which, as I say, he mastered as a very young man. The shastra of sentences, that is the Mimamsa, hermeneutics, and the shastra of pramana, epistemology, which can most naturally be interpreted to be nyaya. Most normally interpreted as Nyaya. Of course, apart from the Nyaya system in the strict sense, there were other systems too, which can be called Pramana or Tarka. But okay, at least it seems clear that Jayanta really is a Padavakya Pramana Gyaha. And beyond this, on the religious level, he is a Shaiva, we can say. That is to say that Shiva is his Ishta Devata, at least. Again, see the Nyayamandiri. Okay, so now the part of the Nyayamandiri that we're going to read then is a bit longer than I realized when I suggested the topic to Gavin. I had just some vague memory of having read this passage once or twice in the fairly distant past and enjoying it very much and wishing to return to it myself, as I said, to understand better the whole, all of these debates about Apavarga, about liberation. This section is the ninth Achnika. It's quite long, so I'm afraid we will only be able to scratch the surface indeed. If we wanted to read the whole Achnika, which would be wonderful to do because it's absolutely fantastic, and I think you should read it as a whole to see the whole structure and everything, but I'm afraid that would require us to read daily for more than 2 hours, for at least a whole term, probably. I don't know. Depends on how carefully you want to read it, of course, but something like that. Where are we in the whole text, in the Nyayamandiri? We're in the ninth Achnika. We're fairly near the end of the text, actually. Yeah, we're sort of nearing the end. So he first discusses, the first part of the Nyayamandiri is basically about Pramana, which is the first of the Nyaya Padarthas. Did I get a hand on this? Maybe I can peek at your hand up too. The first part of the Nyayamandiri is about epistemology, if you like, pramana, with very important discussions. This is certainly, that includes certainly some of the most important parts of the text, especially about shabda pramana, the validity of the Vedas. This is really the main thing, perhaps. But then he follows the sequence of the padarthas as they're taught in the Nyaya system, listed in the Nyaya Sutra 111. And the second of the padarthas is prameya, object of knowledge. Pramana is the means of knowledge. Prameya is the object of knowledge. And prameya is divided into 12 in Nyaya Sutra 119, which is on your handout in the first item there. So in the Nyayamandiri, he follows the sequence. He's going through the padarthas. So after pramana, which takes up more than half the book, we come to prameya. And prameya is atman, sharira, indriya, artha. Artha here is indriya, artha. Buddhi, manaha, pravritti, dosha, pratibhava, paladukkha, and apavarga, these 12. And the way that these are divided, you can see their relative importance. Atman gets, basically these 12 are covered in three achnikas, three chapters of the book. The first chapter is devoted to the first, to Atman. The second chapter is devoted to the second up to the 11th, sharira up to dukkha. And the third chapter is devoted to apavarga. So the big ones are Atman, which is a subject of dispute with the Buddhists, again, above all, and liberation. Those are the big ones. And then the others are sort of crammed into it. The three Achnikas are more or less the same length. Actually, the Atman one is, I think, slightly, a little bit the longest of the three. But Apavarga is nearly as long as Atman. Okay, so that's where we are in the text. And we should imagine that we have studied the Nyayamandri up to this point, that we have learned about Pramana, and that we have also learned in the preceding two Achnikas about Atman, and about the other Prameyas up to and including Dukkha. And now we start. Shall I read? I mean, we could also would also be fun in a way to read it together, that is to say, with others taking their turn. But because our time is so limited, it seems, we have only today, tomorrow, and then 2 days next week. Maybe it's quicker if we don't do that, and instead I read mainly this time, and you chip in whenever you want. So, what are we reading from anyway? I have printouts of these two editions. I'm sorry, I said in my email that I would try, I hoped we would also be able to look at manuscript evidence, manuscript material. I'm afraid I haven't yet got any. That is, I had a number of Nyayamandri manuscripts on my hard disk, but I couldn't find this part in any of them. Most of the Nyayamandri manuscripts in existence seem to be incomplete. There are a lot, by the way, which prompts me again to briefly digress and point out that this work is not only interesting from and important, I would say, from our perspective, but that it was really fairly well known within India, perhaps especially in Kashmir, as you would expect, or Kashmirian authors maybe are those who quote it the most frequently, I'm not sure. But it was also known elsewhere. It was studied, Jayanta's works were studied by the Jainas, but they were also studied by Brahminical authors in South India, for instance. We have some important South Indian manuscripts of the Nyayamandri in Malayalam script. So I'm sorry that I don't have the manuscript evidence to really re-edit the text before your eyes together or whatever, which would be very nice to try to do. Maybe I can manage to get some manuscript with this section in it before next week, I'm hoping. Let's see. But for the moment, we just muddle on with these two editions and with the Granthi Bhanga, which, however, doesn't chip in very much until later in the text. Anyway, the text is not too bad, I think. Maybe a few points where one can have some doubts. So let me start. Evam sharirada dhukka paryante he pramey nirnite. Sorry, I'm reading from the Mysore edition for the moment. You can keep your eye on the other one, if you like. Yad arta etad upadeshaha. Yat param upadeyam prameyam. Yad arta ha shastra rambaha. Tam apavargam lakshetam. Aha. Tadatyanta vimokshopavargaha. So he introduces the first the sutra defining apavarga. I'll try a translation. So we start with the locked of absolute phrase, the prameya. So again, this is the second category, second of the padarthas, the object of knowledge, or let's say objects of knowledge. No need to keep the janto ekavachanam. The objects of knowledge, beginning with the body, or from the body up to dukkha, suffering, if you wish. Those objects of knowledge which are to be eliminated or transcended, heya, body up to dukkha, having been thus evam, nirnita, having been thus settled, in the sense that now nirnaya has been produced regarding them. We now know, if you have studied my text up to this point, if we have studied the text, we should now have certain knowledge exactly about what each of these is. So that having been done, now, he says, the sage says, Akshapada Gautama says, the following sutra, in order to characterize lakshayitum, to give the defining characteristic of, in order to characterize that liberation, tam apavarga, and this apavarga is described, important things are said about it with relative phrases. This is normal syntax, of course, in Sanskrit. Sometimes it's hard to render these things literally in English. English does not love the relative correlative construction in the way that Sanskrit does. That liberation, which is the goal, or for the sake of which the teaching of these. You start to translate it literally. It starts beyond. Aiming at which all of these have been taught. Okay, all kinds of other things have been taught up to now, but the whole point of that teaching, etat upadesha, I think we take it best as a etesham, meaning shariradinam. Okay, what's the point of learning about what is the body, etc.? Well, the point of all that teaching is this liberation. Yadartha is a compound. Okay? He's relative correlative, especially when they're in compound. It's, if you try to translate him literally into English, your head may start to explode. But you need to get to the point where it becomes natural to you in Sanskrit to understand it. Yeah, it's very basic Sanskritic syntax. Another one, yat param upadeyam prameyam. This time the yat, the relative, is not in compound. That the upavarga, which is the supreme. It is that object of knowledge which is supremely to be sought after, to be gained, upadeya, to be realized. And the third one, yadartaha, again, shastra rambha. Even more, the whole point of the nyaya, the whole point of starting the nyaya, of teaching the nyaya, and studying the nyaya, is this liberation. The shastra rambha has this apavarga alone as its artaha. So yadartaha is a bahuvrihi. Okay, so he said three things about Abhavarga there with those three relative clauses. All of the preceding section, all of the preceding teachings actually are sarta because of this liberation. Okay, it is their arta, it is the art of that teaching. And it is completely different from these other prameyas that have just been taught. They are heya, whereas this is param upadeya, a supreme thing to be realized. And finally, it is this apavarga, which is, in fact, not only it is the point of teaching the previous heya prameyas, but it is the point of the whole nyaya. Sorry, Alexa.
You're taking palamam adjectivally or adverbially? You translate it in two different ways.
Indeed. I think one could, in fact, take it either way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't you think?
I would have thought that if it was intended adverbially, he would have said paramopadeyam.
Maybe.
To remove the ambiguity. But
Maybe, indeed. It is the supreme object of object to be sought after. Yeah, fine. Absolutely. So, three things we have said about it. In order to characterize the Abhavarga, which is as described by these three clauses, he now says, Tadatyanta vimoksha Abhavarga. Abhavarga is the total or the final liberation or freedom, vimoksha, from that tat. Now, what does tat refer to? He tells us immediately. Tat iti prakrantasya tukasya avamarsha. The pronoun tat in the compound there, it's in compound, refers to dukkha, suffering, which was the topic on hand. It's prakranta, yeah. It's not, we're just changing the topic here. We're moving, now the topic is going to be apavarga, but dukkha, as you saw, is the prameya immediately preceding Abhavarga on the list. So the last part of the previous Achnika is the discussion of dukkha. So it's perfectly natural indeed that tat, and of course in the sutras too, 1122 follows 1121, which is the definition of dukkha. Maybe here it's worth quickly looking at the handout. Sorry, I didn't manage to put very much on the handout, but for this particular passage, I think we've more or less covered the first part of item one, but it may be worth here looking at this brief passage, two verses, which I quoted from slightly earlier in the Nyayamanjari, to clarify again the how the 12 prameyas can be divided in terms of heya and upadeya. So Jayanta summarizes this neatly as follows. Tatra dehadi dukkantam heyam eva vyavastitam. Upadeyo, sorry, there's a typo there. Not upadeyo, but upadeyo. First typo. Upadeyo pavargastu dvedavastitir atmanaha. I think we have to read on. Sukha dukkhadi bhoktva svabhavo hi eva saha upadeyas tu bhogadi vyavahara paramukaha. So he says, among these objects of knowledge, tatra, those which begin with the body, from body up to suffering, dehadi dukkantam, are established as only here, here meva. They are totally to be transcended. This is from the point of view of this is for mumukshus, by the way. Not everybody is necessarily a mukshu at any given moment. So from other standpoints, they might not totally be heya, but from the for mumukshus, they are completely heya, heya meva, only heya. Upadeya upavargastu. However, upavarga is upadeya, that is to be sought after, that is to be realized. Whereas the soul is, it has two natures. Dvidavastitir atmanaha. Okay? So, sharira up to dukkha are purely heya, just heya, heya meva. Upavarga is equally purely, although there's no eva fitted into the verse, it is upadeya. But the soul has a double mode, if you like. It has two modes. Namely, it, saha, the soul, is heya eva. It is absolutely to be transcended. Sukha dukkhadi bhoktva svabhavo. Inasmuch as it has as its nature the being, tva, the state of being, the experiencer, bhoktva, of sukha, pleasure, dukkha, etc. Qua experiencer, the soul, has to be transcended. You should get rid of that soul whose nature is to be the experiencer. Alright? You should make the soul at present in the state of bondage is the experiencer, but this state has to be transcended. On the other hand, upadeyastu, again, understand, atma, the soul, however, is to be realized. What kind of a soul? Not that which is bhoktritvasabhavaha, but the soul as bhogadivyavahara parang mukaha, turned away from, completely averse to. Not bhogadivyavahara. Such vyavahara, such activity as experience. Bhogadivyavahara. Maybe? Nexus?
First question, what does Adi refer to there?
Yeah. Well, we could say it perhaps refers also to action. Yes. Good.
Yes. Bhoga enjoying the experiencing the results of action as opposed to kriya, which is actually the actions which lead to kriya.
Yes. That's perhaps the first one there. Indeed, I agree. It's slightly odd.
A little bit weak.
I agree.
I can think of something more specific. The business of
the
Bhoga,
business of
it.
Bhoga. I agree. It's slightly weak.
But it suggests perhaps mundane vyavahara, averse to the business, as we might say in English, of experience, etc., experiencing the fruits of actions.
Maybe. I find the expression slightly odd indeed. But anyway, I think the basic point is clear. Of the 12 pramayas, then, numbers 2 to 11 are purely heya. Number 12 is purely upadeya, whereas the Atman sort of, okay, depends on how the Atman is functioning, if you like. As a bhoktra, you want to stop that. You want to get rid of such an Atman. Okay, so now let's go back to our upavarga. We know that our upavarga is the supreme upadeya. So, again, in the prose after the sutra, he tells us, first of all, that the pronoun tat refers to dukkha, which was the topic. Nacha mukhyam eva dukkham badana svabhavam avamrishyate kim tu tat sadhanam tad anushaktam cha sarvam eva. And it is not only suffering in the primary or literal sense, mukhyam eva, which is referred to avamrishyate by the pronoun. So to express the idea of reference, what do you call it, by pronouns. You can say paramarsha, or you can say avamarsha, or pratyavamarsha maybe also. it is not only mukhyam eva dukkham, suffering in the primary sense. What is that? Madana svabhava. That is to say, that suffering which actually is pain. Madana here in the context of this definition of the of what dukkha is. Madana is explained in the Nyaya Bhasha, and Jayanta follows this as pida or pidana or tapa or samtapa. So it's not just pain in the literal sense that is meant. Rather, those things that are instrumental to pain, tatsadana, and that which is necessarily connected with pain, tadanushaktamcha, sarvabeva, all of that. So here, tat refers to dukkha in a very wide sense. Mukhya dukkha, but also dukkha in a secondary, in a gauna sense. Tena dukkhena vyogo apavargaha. And liberation is being defined in the sutra as separation from, disjunction from, vyoga. That suffering, that is to say suffering in this very broad sense, anything that is connected with suffering too. If you want to have a quick glance at what this, what these other things might be, well, indeed it is practically everything. In the handout I quoted from the Nyayavartika of Uttiyottakara, he classifies dukkha in to 21. Shariram, the body. Shad indriyani, the six faculties. Shad vishyaha, their objects, the six objects. Shad buddheha, the six associated types of cognition. Dhatava. Pleasure. Pleasure is also suffering. And suffering. So only the last one there, suffering, is the mukhya suffering. Suffering. Everything else there, from the body up to pleasure, is suffering in a secondary sense. Yes, and he says, to be precise, that dukkha, the shariram is dukkha because it is the locus of dukkha, and the 18, the 6, 6 and 6, the indriyas, vishyas and the cognitions, are dukkha because they are sadhana. Indeed, I think that must be why I decided to quote this, because he uses the same terminology of sadhana and anushakta, tat sadhana, tat anushakta. Well, sukha is dukkha, pleasure is suffering, because it is dukkha anushakta. It is always connected with suffering. Echoes of Buddhism here? I think there are definitely echoes of Buddhism here, as quite often in Nyaya, at least in the, especially in the older Nyaya. Okay, so let's go back maybe to Jayanta. Asti, I think that's where we go on. Asti pralaya velayam api atmano dukkha vyogaha. The api is nice, of course. I notice it's missing in one of the manuscripts used by the editor, apparently. And there is a slight tendency on the whole in the transmission to add particles, I think. So it's possible it's not original, but... okay, can't say much yet. I haven't looked at any manuscripts myself. Now, there is indeed asti, emphatically at the head of the sentence. There does exist. Atmano dukkha vyogaha. Separation from suffering exists for the soul. The soul does have separation from suffering at the time of pralaya, at the time of dissolution, when everything is taken apart, falls apart back into the constituent, goes into a kind of atomic soup, basically, for this for these guys. They are realists, you remember? So at that time too, or the api again might not be original, the soul has no suffering. It is separated from suffering. Satu apavargo nabhavati. Sarga same punar akshira karmashe anurupa sharira disambande sati dukkha sambhavat. But that, in other words, this pralaya kale dukkha vyogaha, the separation at the, from suffering, freedom from suffering at the time of dissolution, that is not apavarga. That is not liberation. Why not? Because when it is time for creation again, when creation comes around again, sarga samaye, suffering arises, dukkha sambhavat. I think it's arise rather than just be possible. Definitely it's going to come. Suffering arises again when there is, let's see, or since there is, locative absolute, punar akshina, Dakshina Karmashya Anurupa Shirat, something like that. Yeah. There being, when there is, or because there is, it really is a cause, the connection, sambandha, the soul is connected again with the body, etc., shariradi, a body, etc., agreeing with anurupa, fitting to the karma or karmashya. You notice there's a variant there. Manuscript ga is reported as reading simply karma anurupa. The other manuscript or manuscripts reads karmashya anurupa. It's not going to really affect the sense, I think. Karmashya. Chya. They use karmashya a lot. It just basically just means your karma. It means your dharma and adharma. Good and bad karma. It seems to be a genitive tatpurusha, I think. Karma nam ashaya. Maybe for some it is... I find it a difficult term, I must say, karmashya. And the yoga people use it too, I believe, in a slightly different way, maybe. It could either be... I think some take it as something like the whole collection of ashaya, in the sense of the collection of, while others understand it to be more something like the ashaya means something like the what is laid down by the residue of action, in the sense of action, karma in the sense of action, not in the sense of karma, not in the sense of the English word karma, which means the traces of the results of action that's stored in the soul for the nayayikas.
Since you said dharma and adharma,
dharma
and adharma. The disposition towards action, particular disposition.
I don't think this is ashaya in that sense. Of course, it's an important meaning of ashaya, disposition or something like that, but I don't believe that this compound is so understood by the nayayikas. Mm. So, the body, when there is a connection with body, etc., which are anurupa, which match, which agree with, the good and bad karma, karmashya or simply karma, basically means here dharma and adharma, good and bad karma, that have not yet been exhausted, akshina. Punaha goes at dukkha sambhava, perhaps the best. Because at the time of creation, suffering arises again when the soul is connected again. Okay, that again goes with both, if you like. When the soul again is connected with a body, etc., which is going to be a body, etc., that matches his karma. So you don't get heavenly, divine bodies from doing bad deeds. And the other way around, too. You don't get hell bodies or animal bodies, bodies of the denizens of hell, from doing good deeds. So in that sense, the sharira adi, where the adi can refer mainly to the manas and the other indriyas. You get the sharira, etc., that you deserve. Okay, so for this reason, this freedom from suffering in pralaya, which actually everybody has, is not liberation. Ataha tadvyavrityartam atyanta grahanam. Therefore, the sage has also used the word atyanta, final, in order to exclude that type of freedom from suffering. So if Gautama had formulated the sutra as tadvimoksho pavargaha, it would not be a fitting definition. It would have the fault of ativyapti. It includes too much, because simply tadvimoksha, i.e. dukkha vimokshaha, includes also the temporary relief from suffering during the period of sleep, so to say. Mm. Okay, so that's very clear, I think. This is why the sutra is formulated with the word atyanta in it, final. Okay? Atyantiki dukkha nivrittir apavargaha na savadika. It would be nice to have some kind of a connecting, perhaps, particle or something there. Look, liberation, apavarga, is an absolutely final atyantiki cessation of suffering, and not a cessation of suffering which has a temporal limit, savadika, which will itself come to an end. So the dukkha vyoga or dukkha nivritti at the time of pralaya is savadika. That separation from suffering only lasts as long as God decides to allow us to rest. Takes a rest himself. But what we are talking about here as the Param Upadeyam, the supreme thing to be sought after, is not that. It is an absolutely final and guilty freedom from suffering. Dvivita dukkha vamarshina sarvanamna sarvesham atmagunanam dukkha vat avamarshat atyanta grahanena cha sarvatmana tadvyoga pidanat navanam atmagunanam buddhi sukha dukkhe cha dvesha prayatna dharma dharma samskaranam nirmulo chedha apavargaha iti uktam bhavati. It's sort of interesting what is being done here. We making a link between an old definition in the Nyaya of Apavarga simply as final separation from suffering. We're making a link between that. He wants to try to show that this is identical with a concept of liberation as the total disappearance of Nirmulocheda, of the gunas. Actually, he means the vishesha gunas of the soul, the qualities, that is to say, actually, the special qualities of the soul. If you like, it's a link between the old Nyaya view and a vaisheshika type view, or something like that. And he's going to try to show that they're exactly the same. We really can identify the two. So he says, I think we have two ablatives, and they both are pointing forward, it looks like. Since the pronoun sarvanaman, sarvanamna there, that refers to the two kinds of suffering. By two kinds he means mukhya and gauna. The pronoun which refers to suffering, both in the limited sense, literal sense, and in the extended sense where it covers basically everything, refers to all of the atmagunas, sarvesham atmagunanam avamarshat, dukkhavat, as I hope it's not going to be. It is going to be. All right. just as suffering. The formulation is slightly odd to me at the moment. Dukkhavat avamarshat. It's slightly strange. I slightly doubt the text, but unfortunately we have no variants reported here. The other edition had the same, I think. I think the formulation really is suspect, but anyway, let's see. The basic idea again, at least. Maybe the text has been slightly crippled, but the basic idea still comes through, that he wants to say that this word tat must refer also equally to all of the vishesha gunas, the gunas or the vishesha gunas of the soul. And that is reason number one of a marshat. Then it's linked with the cha to another ablative. And since it is the total sarvatmana, separation from that, tat, from all of this, which is referred to, expressed abhidhanat by the inclusion of the use of the word atyanta. Okay, so the two points are, one, tat has to also include the atmagunas, and two, atyanta means total. So because of these two reasons, uktam bhavati, blah blah iti uktam bhavati. It amounts to saying that the following, dot dot dot, amounts to being said. It is basically said. You say something, uktam bhavati means, okay, it seems not to be said at first sight, but actually it is being said, it really is being said. If you simply understand what the pronouns refer to and what atyantam means, then the sutra actually means the same as, it's basically saying that apavarga, liberation, is nirmulo chedaha, the cutting off without leaving the slightest trace of a root from which it could grow back, image of uprooting a tree, plant. It is the restless. It is the utter eradication of the nine qualities of the self, of the soul. Navanam atmagunanam, and they are listed: buddhi, cognition, sukha, pleasure, dukkha, suffering, in a narrow sense. Iccha, inclination, dvesha, disinclination, dislike, prayatna, effort, dharma and adharma, good and bad karma. So those are indeed nine. I left out samskara and samskaras, traces, mental traces. So again, these, he calls them the nine atma gunas, but we know that he cannot mean this literally, because the atma has other gunas too, as listed on your handout, item 3. The atman has more than these nine gunas. It has, in addition to these, sankhya, number, sankhya, parimana, pratattva, samyoga, and vibhaga, five further ones. So indeed, the Vaisheshikas say, and the Nayayikas know that it is true. They accept it too. The atma, in fact, has 14 gunas. So atma guna here stands for atma vishesha guna. And this usage is found elsewhere too. And maybe it's found on the next page, because I don't know if you managed to look ahead to that yet. But on the next page, after the verses at the top, around the middle of the page, you have Tad evam navanam atma vishesha gunanam. But notice that there's a variant there, which has again simply atma gunanam. So vishesha might be a secondary clarification again coming in. But I mean, it's not a wrong clarification. He really does use atma guna in the sense of atma visheshika. Do not read this as a cryptic attack on the visheshikas, trying to say, no, you're wrong about the soul having these other qualities. Absolutely not. He absolutely accepts those. This is quite clear if you read the Nyayamantras. Such a thing as parimana, and all the Nyayakas accept this parimana, size. Atman is mahat in the classical view. Okay, so we simply accept this, that it's terminologically okay to say atma-guna in the sense of those specific qualities of the soul, that is to say the qualities which only the soul among all substances has. Still there's something slightly rough, don't you think, about what is being done here. And this roughness, as I say, I think comes from this, the fact that what is being done is something, if you like, ahistorical. It's a linking of two things which originally have a separate birth. I mean, you feel it also indeed in the use of dukkha, because actually dukkha here in this list is not the same as dukkha in the other. The dukkha in this list is the Vaisheshika dukkha, which is simply a quality of the soul. It doesn't refer to the body and other things. So you really sense this. But of course, Jayanta is not unique by any means. By his time, it's absolutely normal. Long before his time, centuries before his time, the Nayayikas had, on a very large scale, adopted a lot of course, not everything of the Vaisheshika building blocks. Okay, so now we go to the verses, maybe. If there are questions, please. If anything is unclear. Sorry. So yavat atma gunaha, in the verse 2, he has it. Yavat atma gunaha sarve no chinna vasanadayaha tavat atyantiki dukkha vyavrittir navakalpate. As long as all of the special, in brackets, qualities of the soul, atma gunaha sarve, beginning with vasanas, latent impressions, now, I have a slight doubt about vasana, because I don't think he means samskara. Because samskara is always the last in that list. On the other hand, of course, vasana also definitely is not buddhi. I think vasana here means dharma and adharma. And, of course, traditionally they are not listed first, but he mentions them first here because they are the most important, in fact. Because that's karma, that is what is causing the whole thing to carry on. So probably, I mean, you don't have to believe me, but I suggest the possibility that I think it myself probable that here by vasana he means dharma and adharma. As long as the qualities of the soul, beginning with vasanas, have not been eradicated, so long, tavat, a final atyantiki, separation from suffering, ending of suffering, navakalpate, won't work. It's not possible. Dharma dharma nimittohi sambhavah sukha dukkha yoho mulabhuta uchatav eva stambhav samsara satmanah. 4. The arising of happiness and of suffering, sukha dukkha yoho sambhava, is caused by dharma and adharma. It is karma that causes the experience of unpleasant experiences. Dharma dharma nimittohi bahuvrihi, as you can see from the gender. Okay, so the sukha and dukkha is sort of the level on which an ordinary person approaches life. So, okay, I'm feeling happy now. No, not so happy anymore. Those sukha and dukkha of our experience are based on dharma and adharma. And, indeed, it is exactly those. Tav eva. It is exactly sukha and dukkha. Dharma and adharma, sorry. This is dharma and adharma, of course. It is precisely that, karma. It is dharma and adharma. Those two, which are the foundational pillars, the pillars which are really carrying the whole structure of the house of samsara, samsara sadmanaha. When he says mula bhuta stambao, he actually means mula stamba bhuta, it seems to me. I think we can allow him this slight freedom, if you like. They are, so to speak, Buddha, the root pillars, the basic pillars. They are the two pillars which are, so to speak, the basis. Okay, means they are, the two pillars which are holding up the house. Yeah, exactly. If you can just knock those down, the whole house of samsara will collapse. There's something slightly similar in the Agama Dambara, but there it actually it's in the Buddhist Paksha. So, of course, it's not dharma and adharma, it's atma graha or something like that. But, I mean, a similar metaphor, except samsara kara garasya.
Yeah. Something in Tantra Lokra as well, very similar.
Don't you think that Abhinavagupta probably had read Jayanta?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, in Jayanta...
Definitely on the curriculum.
Yeah.
And then at Kashmirians at that time. Yeah.
What his commentator definitely quotes him often, but I think Abhinav himself, indeed. Yeah, you can learn almost all of your basic shastra just from the Nyanmanjari. Maybe not quite all, but it's pretty good coverage. Yeah. So mula bhuta chataveva. I think this is okay. So he's starting out with these two, dharma and adharma. They are the stambas. Tad uccheditu tad karya sharirādyanupaplavat natmanah sukha dukkhe staha ityasau mukta uccete. But when, if we read two, I see there's a variant he, another for when, which would also not be bad. I'm not sure that I can really choose between the two at the moment. Let's go for the printed two, just for the moment. But when they are eradicated, tad uccheti, when dharma and adharma are eradicated, then tad karya sharirādi anupaplavat. I find this usage just slightly odd, perhaps, but I'm not sure. Because there is no more... Now, upaplava usually means a disaster, something that harms. Here, however, it seems to be used more in the sense of an action noun. Because there is no more harming, because otherwise he should have said if... You could say that sharirādi are upaplavas, but then you should say upaplava abhavat or something like that. He says anupaplavat, because one is no longer negatively affected, anupaplavat, by the body, etc., which are results of, products of, which are caused by dharma and adharma. It's your karma that produces your body, etc. So if you eradicate dharma and adharma, okay, then body is going to go. And then since body and the whole apparatus that goes with it of faculties, etc., since those are eradicated, they cannot negatively affect the soul anymore. Okay? And therefore, the soul, Atma, Atmanaha, does not have sukha and dukkha. You eliminate dharma and adharma, that eliminates the body. You eliminate the body, how are you going to experience pleasure and suffering? So, iti, he, the soul, is then said to be free. Mukta uccate. Itcha dvesha prayatnadi bhogayatana bandhanam uccinda bhogayatana natma tair api yuchate. As for the rest, So up till now, he has, in the verses, he has discussed four qualities. Dharma, adharma, sukha, dukkha. There are nine. Atma visheshagunas, what about the rest? Okay, well, ichad vesha priyatnadi, all of the rest. They are caused by, they depend on the bhogayatana, the locus of experience, which means the body. Bhogayatana is simply a term for the body here. Buddhists maybe also use it. Maybe the Buddhists don't use it so much. I think upabhogayatana is found in both Buddhism, some Buddhist texts, and early Nyaya. Later Nyayakas, I think, tend to use bhogayatana rather than upabhogayatana. Anyway, very minor terminological thing. Bhogayatana equals sharira. Icha, volition, etc., icha, desire or liking, aversion, volition, etc., they all require a body. So, the soul, atma, when it is uccinna bhogayatana bahuvrihi, when its body has been eradicated, has been eliminated, when you eliminate the body, the soul is not connected, it cannot be connected with those either, taya api. It will be free also of iccha, dvesha, etc.
So if you were writing Bhogayatana Bandhanam in prose, you would keep it as Bhogayatana Nibandhanam.
Nibandhanam, exactly. Yeah. I think he often does this, but uses this Bandhana for Nibandhana in verses. Yeah. Maybe even sometimes in prose, but I quite agree with you. In prose, we would usually say Nibandhanam.
Nibandhanam.
Absolutely. Okay, so he has thus explained the cause of samsara is basically dharma and adharma. They are what's holding it up, keeping it going. Eliminate that, and all of this tumbles down, is eradicated. All of the nine visheshagunas of the soul can no longer be connected with them. Pranasya kshut pipase dve, typo. Pranasya kshut pipase dve, loba mohau cha chetasaha, shitatapau sharirasya, shad urmi rahitah shivaha. Completely foreign to the old Nyaya or Vaisheshika, I think, this idea of the Shad Urmis. Interesting that he brings it in here. In a verse which doesn't read all that smoothly, so we start with a list of six and understand these are the six Urmis, and then Shad Urmi Rahitaha Shivaha. What are the six Urmis? The six waves. Pranasya Kshut Pipase Dve. Hunger and thirst are the two waves of, that is to say related to, that is to say that effect. They are the two disturbances of the vital breath, energy, vital energy, prana. When you feel hunger or thirst, it's the prana that is suffering there. Not the body. Because most of the time, okay, if you really starve yourself, then the body is also being. But the point is, you usually start to feel hungry and thirsty long before the body really is so much in need. It's the prana is seen as being what is affected there. Loba mohaucha, and greed or avarice and delusion are the two that affect the mind. Shitatapau sharirasya. As for the body, it has its own disturbances. They are cold and heat. Once one gets rid of these six urmis, well, obviously you are happy. Shivaha. Sorry, adding a few words in there. Actually, I'd be curious if anybody, maybe Alexis, can tell me if there's an earlier source for exactly this list of six urmis, because doing a quick search, I mean, which is not a very reliable thing, but anyway, doing a quick search, I couldn't find this particular six. The more common, I think your last note on your handout, on page 2 of the handout, yes, most authors who speak of, who use this notion of six urmis, list them as ashanaya, pipasa, okay, that's basically the same as kshut and pipasa, shoka, moha, instead of loba and moha, and then instead of cold and heat, the two affecting the body are jara and mrityu. And this goes back to Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, though the word urmi is not used there, but the set of six with this clear 2-2-2 structure is there. Anyway, I think Jayanta must have had some earlier source, but it's not one that I could find with my primitive searching. I noticed that somebody left, and I wonder if that is connected with the fact that it is 3 o'clock. Do we have to stop?
Well, we don't have to.
There's a conflicting lecture.
Okay, right. We could carry on a little bit, maybe. Okay. If nobody, I mean, anybody who needs to go, please feel free to go. Yeah, as I say, in that last verse, he suddenly brings in this shadow army concept. I don't at the moment at least recall any earlier Nayayika who did that, but I'm not sure. Okay, let's at least read the next, the summary. Tat evam navanam atma gunanam or atma vishesha gunanam, both readings found in the manuscripts apparently, nirmulo cheda apavarga iti yat uchate, tat evedam uktam bhavati, tadatyanta vimoksha apavarga iti. This is a nice pendant, to the sentence at the bottom of the previous page in the Mysore edition. This, at the bottom of the previous page, he was arguing that when Gautama says, tad atyanta vimoksha apavargaha, this is actually the same as saying, atmagunanam navanam atmagunanam nirmulo cheda apavargaha. And this sentence is doing it the other way around. It is saying, when you say, liberation is the total nirmula, eradication of the 9 specific qualities of the soul, when you say that, you are saying exactly this, exactly the following, tad evedam uktam bhavati, namely the sutra. Tad atyanta vimoksha apavargaha iti. So you see that they are parallel. If you are like, the point is that in the previous page he is saying, when Gautama defines apavarga in this way, he's saying exactly the same as the Vaisheshikas do. And here he's saying, when the Vaisheshikas define it in this way, they're saying exactly the same as what Gautama says. So it's perfectly, what do you call it?
Congruent.
Congruent, yeah. There's some other word in mathematics, which I completely forget. I mean, A times B is the same as B times A, but it's not true that A divided by B is the same as B divided by A. What is that word for that one? Ah, it begins with a C. But I'm afraid I haven't used it since high school or something. Okay, anyway, he's showing that it's reciprocal, whatever it is, yeah. Each definition exactly implies the other. It's saying exactly the same as the other. With regard to which, by the way, one other very tiny remark on the terminology or the precise formulations. Interestingly, it struck me as slightly interesting, this exact formulation, nirmulo cheda apavargaha, which he seems to like, navanam atma gunanam nirmulo cheda apavargaha, which he seems to like as the precise wording for the Vaisheshika view, is not used by any other author that I could see at all. I mean, of course, it's exactly the same idea, but they don't use precisely this term nirmulo cheda. They say other things like abhava or atyanta abhava or something like that. Okay, now let's go on at least a little bit more, if you guys still can all stay a little bit longer. Nanu, tasyam avastayam kidrik atma vishishyate svarupaika pratishtana parityakto kilair gunaihi. Now this is why the chapter Achnika is going to go on a bit. We can't just stop here by explaining the definitions. This is very controversial. The Nayayika and the Vaisheshika view, if you think about it, might not sound attractive. Might not sound attractive to everybody. You're saying that liberation is the total eradication, so that they never come back, of cognition, pleasure, suffering. Okay, we all wanted to get rid of suffering, but you're saying that also pleasure is gone. But even awareness, cognition, is gone. So somebody, naturally enough, objects. But in that situation, tasyam avastayam, in that state, what kind of a self is left? Kidrik atma avashishyate. Svarupaika pratishtanaha. It is, okay, that sounds positive in itself, actually, maybe. Svarupaika pratishtanaha. It is entirely resting only in its own nature. Free of, abandoned by, parityakta, without all of those qualities of it. Akilaihi gunaihi, where again the gunas means the vishesha gunas. Urmi shatkatikam rupam tad asyahur manishinaha. Sapsara bandhanadina dukkha kleshadya dushitam. Okay, this is his reply. The wise, Manishinaha, call this its nature, its rupa, free of going beyond the six waves, urmishatkartikam rupam. Yeah, okay. What is it? What is this? What kind of soul is left? Well, the soul is left in its nature that goes beyond the six waves, the six disturbances. It is unspoiled adushita. It is not negatively affected by dukkha, klesha, etc. Suffering, disturbances, etc. which are dependent on adina. They are caused by bondage in samsara. Okay, so this is, up to this point, I think, is basically... Okay, we had the little nanu, but basically this is just the presentation of his own view. And now we're going to get the real fighting started. Okay, can we do a little bit more? Mm-hmm. Just a little. I think probably people will run out of oxygen and something at some point soon, but maybe we can do a little bit more. Atra tavat vedantinaha ahu. Nayam idrisho, type 1 in the Mysore edition. Idrisho mokshaha prekshavatam prayatna bhumir bhavitum arhati. Now, to this, the Vedantins say, this liberation, of this kind, I am Idrisho Moksha. Idrisho, yeah, it should be Idrisho. This liberation, of this nature, being as you described it, cannot be, does not deserve to be. A prayatna bhumihi, the object of effort for people who think about what they are doing, who are prekshavan, who are preksha purvakarinam, who are rational, yes, exactly, who are not just blindly following what somebody said, okay, or just blindly running about without following anything, like a chicken with its head cut off, okay. People who think before they act, who are prekshavat or prekshapurvakarin, they will never strive, put great energy and effort into achieving a state in which they have no sukha, dukkha, no sukha or jnana. Those are the main things. The main issue is going to be sukha and jnana here. Kohi nama shila shakala kalpam apagata sakala sukha samvedana samsparsham atmanam upapadayitum yateta. For who, indeed, would strive, yateta, to make himself atmanam upapadayitum shila sakala kalpam, shila shakala kalpam, no better than a splinter of stone, shila shakala kalpam, devoid of, bahuvrihi with apagata at the beginning, devoid of the contact with all pleasurable sensations, sakala sukha samvedana samsparsham, apagata sakala sukha samvedana samsparsham. Okay, that's the two things. So the first one, shila shakala kalpam, mainly then has to do perhaps with jnana, absence of cognition, jagatva is being expressed there by that metaphor, and the other one has to do with absence of pleasurable sensation. Who would try to reduce himself to equality with a stone?
Does it actually say reduce to the quality of a stone?
No, it says make him. Yeah. But I think from the perspective of the speaker here, this is definitely a loss. Yeah. This is an objection to the Vaisheshika Nyayika view, is it not?
It's commonly formulated in this way, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
They seek a moksha, which is that the state of a stone.
Exactly. Pashana
void of consciousness.
Pashana tulyatvam.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, and indeed it seems remarkable, of course. But we don't have time to read a huge amount of this chapter, but maybe at least enough that we start to see how Jayanta tries to rationalize it. Of course, it certainly is easy to laugh at the view, but the Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas are not the only Indian thinkers who held views which are somewhat similar. Of course, for instance, some Buddhists, many Buddhists, hold views which are not too far different from this again. Yeah. This is one of the big things. If you try to look at the whole spectrum of what is going on, or the debates on this thing, one of the big things is the soul, when you're liberated, do you maintain individual, some kind of individuality, individual existence, ontologically? Or do you merge into some, do you completely lose all individuality? This is one of the big things, say the big divides. And another of the big divides is a question of sukha, especially. Is liberation a state in which you experience sukha or not? Yeah. The most common verse criticizing this Vaisheshikata view, which is very often cited, I don't know what the original source is, it's cited by Brahminical authors, Jaina authors, and Buddhist authors, I think, there are variants on it too. Varam vrindavane ramye shrigalatvam abhipsitam, and there are variants there. Natu vaisheshikim muktim gautamo gantum itchati, something like that. Okay, I'd rather become a jackal, be born as a jackal in the Vrindavana, which is at least very delightful, especially if you're a Vaishnava, of certain persuasions. That would be much better. No, I don't want to become liberated. Ala Vaisheshika. Vaisheshikim. I wonder, where is a good place to stop? Shall we stop here, or shall we do another sentence? So padi sa vadika parimita ananda nishandat svargat api adikam anavadika niratishaya naisarika ananda sundaram aparimlana tatsamvedana samartyam chaturtam purushatam achakshate vichakshanaha.
Mistake here, no?
Achakshate. Achakshate, yeah. Indeed, several typos in this edition, I'm afraid. So this is still the Vedantin speaking, and the Vedantin say, the wise, Vichakshanaha, teach that the fourth goal of man, Chaturtam Purushartam, in other words, liberation, is beyond even, it is greater even than heaven, Svargat Api Adikam. Heaven, which is Sopadi Savadika Parimita Anandani Shandat. Not sure if I want to take that as a bahuvrihi or not at the moment. Heaven in which there is the outflowing of bliss, which is, however, still sopadika, somehow limited, and savadika, also temporarily limited. So the upadi is not necessarily a temporal limitation, but a limitation of its nature. And the avadi is a limitation of time, and parimita, finite. Okay, heaven is that. In heaven we experience bliss, but that bliss is not ultimate.
Contingent.
It's contingent, exactly.
On particular sources of pleasure.
Exactly. It's the pleasure in heaven is always finite because it has a direct relationship to the punya that you did, the dharma that you accumulated to buy it. Okay? There's no. This is an economy here that we're talking about, and there's no such thing as infinite in it. You can accumulate a huge amount of punya, and this will get you a very high quality heaven for a long time, but it can never be non-contingent indeed. It's always relative, in other words, it never is absolute. And hence the rather neat criticism by Bhartrahari, the Subhashita of Bhartrahari, I mean, whoever wrote most of those verses. It's a very nice verse which starts like it. Oh dear. I forget how it begins now. Enough of the Vedas, it starts something like that. What use are the Vedas? Alam Veda, he wants. Enough of all this Shastra, all of these rituals, all of these Shastras, etc., which are Swarga Grama Kuti Nivasa Paladaihi, something like that, which only will buy you the dwelling in a little hut in the village of heaven. By which he means, okay, heaven looks very great, and those palaces look very wonderful from our perspectives. Okay, it's much better than our houses here, even our palaces here. But it's all a matter of perspective. If you take a larger perspective, you can say, oh, well, this is also very trivial. Is that all? It's also limited, okay. So so much pleasure, but it's still always limited. Is that all? You can always desire more. It's a sort of that's a very nice verse, but I say Kim Vedaihi Smriti Bihi Purana Patanaihi Shastrair Mahavistraihi is how it starts, yeah. Something like that. Sorga Grama Kutini Vasapaladaihi Karma Kriya. This. I forget. Muktvai Kambhavabhava Dukkha Kalanas. Sorry, my memory absolutely fails me, but you can look it up for yourself. It's a rather beautiful verse. Anyway, making a similar point about the contingency and the limited nature, the relative nature of the bliss of heaven. So the wise say that the fourth Purushartha, liberation, must be greater than that. It is greater than that. It is anavadika niratishaya naisargika ananda sundara. It is beautiful by the bliss in it, which is anavadika. It is not ending. It has no limit. It has no temporal limit. Niratishaya. It really is transcendent. It cannot be transcended. And it is also naisargika, he says also. It is natural.
As opposed to
sopatika, the sequence in which it does not match, but seems to be indeed. Aparimlana tatsamvedana samartyam, in which the ability to experience that bliss is, of course, not diminished. It does not
ever fresh.
Yeah.
Never fading.
Yeah. So you should be able to experience this bliss. There should be the bliss, and there should be the awareness of the bliss. You should be able to have experiences, and some vedana here in this state. Okay, maybe we can stop there then for the day. And maybe we can continue simply from here tomorrow, because I think I wanted to initially at least read up to, I forget what I wrote, but probably it was page 433, the middle. And after that we could consider if we jump. Well, I'll consider this evening, maybe. Whether we jump or just continue, because it's also attractive just to read in sequence. But okay. Thank you very much.
We could have 5 minutes questions if anybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm still curious about the difference between the sopadi and the avadi.
Well, I think it's clear the avadi. So avadi. Well, I think
one
it's
was temporal and one was.
Yeah, avadi is temporal. Mm-hmm. That's very clear, I think, always. And the upadi is more about its nature. It has some limitation of its nature. It's somehow its effect. An upadi is something which affects something and does not actually belong to its own nature. Mm. So, for instance, the flower and the crystal. Mm. Okay. But somehow it's colored. And indeed, it seems absolutely natural to take that as contrasting with naisargika, where it's simply the own nature. Natural. Natural bliss and some bliss which is somehow affected by something.
Which arises in response to something.
Exactly. Yeah. Something external to your own nature. Mm-hmm. Naisargika depends only on yourself. But it has nothing to do with time. So it's completely different from the savadika niravadika distinction.
The aparimlana is good. Because all good things become boring in the end.
Except this.
After a while you might not notice that you're in the state of Brahma bliss.
It's what happens in heaven. It's what happens in heaven, presumably, or it could happen in heaven, but not
bored in heaven, but not
in the state of liberation.
So that aparimana is
aparimana.
Aparimana is
parimlana.
Yeah.
From lie to fade, or to wilt of a flower.
In the other edition, really?
Well, we have aparimitta too.
Aparimlana is definitely better if there's a variant, I would have thought.
Oh, I see.
Is there a variant?
It's in the same text.
Yeah, parimitta.
The same edition? Which one?
It's just preceding aparimlana. In the same paragraph.
So parika parimitta. We have parimitta. And you have. So I still don't see really aparimitta, but. Parimitta. No. Aparimana indeed is nice. Anyway, let's say that we have both here. We have sukha, ananda, corresponds, let's say, Okay, we can say it's there is a difference sometimes, but basically it corresponds here to sukha. From the Nyaya Vaisheshika standpoint, there is no such thing as ananda as separate from sukha. Mm. Sukha is the right technical term. Okay. So ananda is sukha, and then samvedana corresponds to buddhi of the vishesha gunas. So there are two vishesha gunas, which the Vedanta insists we want to have in liberation. We want to have bliss, ananda equals, in vaisheshika terms, sukha, and we want to have awareness of that bliss, samvedana, and that would fall under buddhi for the vaisheshika.
About where it talks about the the soul is not connected with these things. And it has
these either.
And so on. Does the soul, when it's liberated, have a quality of Ichha?
No, it does not. Ichha is indeed one of the visheshagunas, whose nirmula uccedaha is apavarga.
So
exactly,
it
does not.
Or not
it doesn't have volition, indeed. It doesn't even have cognition. You have to realize it really is shila shakala kalpam. Yeah. That's right. We're talking about a state in which you have no sensation at all. You're not aware. You are no longer sentient. No bliss of consciousness, absolutely not.
No bliss of consciousness.
Yes.
It's simply the end of suffering, the end of transmigration. The substance itself, the dravya itself, atmas and dravyas for the vaisheshikas, continues to exist. It is indestructible.
Deep state of drunkenness.
Jayanta is going to try to really defend in the following that this is, after all. Okay, he says, maybe it's not what... Okay, people like some nice story about liberation being some sort of transcendent bliss, but we're realists. There isn't such a thing. That's his standpoint.
We're not promising you a party.
No, exactly. No, we're just telling you the facts. You are right now suffering, actually, all the time. Even when you're experiencing sukha, it's actually a subtle dukkha. And the only way to end this suffering is to reach the state where you have no sensation at all. So we're realists, what he said. But, you know, again, this is Jayanta wearing his Nayayika hat. Mm-hmm. And I noticed the other thing, the Agama Dambara, the first verse of it. Do you remember the first verse of it? Tad Brahma Vaha, something. Krama Vinashyatan Adya Vidyam Udyotatam Spurat Amanda Navabinandam. That sounds very... samvit padeva tadanonmuga eva yatra shamyanti kanta vishayantara bhogavanchaha. That really sounds like it's describing he says Brahma. Now Brahma is of course used, in fact it's even used by Pakshalaswami also as describing the state of liberation. one of the words he uses, borrowing it from the Upanishads, of course. It sounds like it's talking about liberation or the attaining liberation. When this state is just descending into the level of awareness, all other desires cease. But he describes it there as full of bliss. So again, he's here writing a Nayayika verse, but does he really hold ultimate? And he defends it as he can defend any position you want, basically. Jayanta. He can defend the Buddhist position as well when he's writing the Purvapaksha, he'll defend it. Yeah. It's not his position. He can defend this Nayayika position, but I'm not sure that we should assume that he himself ultimately thought that this was the nature of liberation. And within the Nyaya school, of course, what he presents here is the main line of Nyaya, sort of the mainstream view. But within the Nyaya school too, there were others who explicitly differed from this, did not toe the line, the party line. Nyaya Bhushanakara is the most famous of these, but I think there are others too. So, yeah.
The expression Ananda Sundara, very common among Kashmirian authors, especially Shaiva Kashmirian authors. And I'm just searching to see if I can find it in any non-Kashmirian author.
I'm curious. Very interesting.
Yeah, Mokshopayatika, I use that's the only non-Shaiva source I can find.
Well, Jayanta, interesting question. How much Shaivism? Shaiva, in the sense of Agamic. had Shaivism. He was aware of the Shaiva Agamas very clearly. Yeah. He may well have studied them. Who knows? Mm. He may well have been sympathetic to them. Mm. I've seen no real trace that he has some sort of leaning or partiality towards. I've not seen no trace of that. But
we have a lot of epigraphical evidence of Shaiva initiates, who are teachers of Nyaya and Vaisheshika.
Absolutely, there's clearly is a link there.
Working in two different domains.
Yeah. I would say we don't have any evidence in the existing works that he had another identity, as it were, but I would agree it's absolutely not impossible.
The opening verses express a very strong devotion.
Yes, but again, of course, the opening verse is Kalpatarbana. But one thing that strikes me also about the opening verses is that the one to the goddess is not only very beautiful and even more beautiful than the one to Shiva, but it also seems to explicitly refer, at least on one level, and it has two meanings, to the goddess being somehow the one who saves.
Mm.
There's a certain strand of Devi, a goddess devotion there. So the opening verse was Namah Shashvatikananda Gyanaishwari Mayatmane Sankalpa Sapala Brahma Stambarambhaya Shambhavi, which is very close, also using some of the words to the opening verse of the Kadamri. And then the second verse is really beautiful. It is Namami Yamininata Leka Lankrita Kuntalam Bhavanim Bhavasantapa Nirvapana Sudhanadim. And Bhavasantapa Nirvapana, so there's two meanings of Bhava there. One level it's samsara. He's saying that the goddess is the one who is a river of nectar that puts out the suffering of samsara. Okay, and Shiva. Bhava can also be Shiva then. So somehow that's indeed, that verse seems quite powerful. It's even that verse, those verses really are fully the equal, it seems to me, of Bana's verses. Bana has also very grand verses at the beginning.
Yeah, he does defend the authenticity of the of the Shaivagava.
Indeed.
On the other hand, he does so at the price of expressing its specific doctrines. He waters it down into a kind of bland, ecumenical perspective. Well, we all believe in God, don't we? Including the Shaivas and the Vaishnavas. The specific doctrines are submerged. So there's no trace there of a particular affiliation to the Siddhanta, or perhaps to a Shakta non-dualist view. He keeps himself concealed. If he is thinking something else, he doesn't show his hand.
No.
Except perhaps in the second opening verse.
You can only feel somehow the an intensity of devotion there.
Well, thank you so much, Brother Isaacson, for sharing this reading with us. And,
It's a beautiful text.
We look forward to tomorrow.
Okay, let's carry on.
Thank you.
Thank you.